Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode of How This Is Building Me, host D. Ross Kamage, MD, PhD, of the University of Colorado, sits down with Nick Abbott, PhD, formerly of Wells Fargo Securities, to discuss the road from bench scientist to biotechnology analyst, rules and regulations in the industry, and more.
Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the challenges, triumphs, ups and downs of all those who deal with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. Now, we just talked about ASCO, the world's largest oncology conference, but I thought we'd try and get some insights into the fact that there's more than one kind of consumer of that and other conferences' updates in the audience. Obviously, there are physicians and their patients wondering if those updates are going to impact their treatment or their standard of care. There are researchers in academia and the pharmaceutical industry interested in whether their development is looking better or worse than other developments and how things are going there. But there's also a parallel universe that is populated by financial analysts who are literally expert fortune tellers into different companies' fortunes. And to help us gain some insights into this parallel world, I am delighted to have with me Nick Abbott. Nick, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you think is appropriate?
Well, good morning, Ross, and thanks for inviting me. Delighted to participate. I recently retired from Wells Fargo, where I was a senior biotechnology analyst in research. It's not the division of Wells Fargo you rock up to with your bank card. It's corporate investment banking. So we're a separate division, and we can go into that in a little bit more detail. But for me, I started life as a bench scientist. I have a PhD in microbiology and somehow managed to persuade a company in America to give me a job after doing my sort of internship at a biotech in Oxford for 6 years.
I looked at your CV and it appears to be you, for a brief period of time, you're the world expert in growing like yeast in vats or something like that.
Yes, right.
But which is cool, but how did you kind of gloss over it. And then somehow I just sort of transitioned to an American company. So What was going on in your head and how did you know what you wanted to transition to?
I worked at a company where we're making recombinant proteins and our vehicle of choice was good old Saccharomyces cerevisiae, so baker's yeast. And so we were introducing plasmids, and then I was responsible for making as much product as possible. I went to the library one day to speak to the librarian. Now, we're talking here early.
When they had books in the libraries, you mean?
Books in the libraries, journals, no internet. He was on the phone. So I picked up a trade magazine. I was leafing through it, and I saw a job advertised at Immunex. And so I looked at the description. I thought, well, that's pretty much exactly what I'm doing. Our youngest son at that time was just a couple of months old. So I applied for the job.
It was another kind of growing yeast sort of job?
Yes, exactly. It was. So Immunex had two divisions. There was manufacturing, the ERDCO research and development, and IMCO manufacturing. So it was for IMCO. They made Leukine, which is an approved neutrophil growth factor. And they had aspirations for bigger and better cytokine-based drugs. And so my job was to expand their knowledge base and expertise in more sophisticated ways to grow the yeast. So instead of just a batch like you would do to make beer, we would have an algorithm based on Michaelis-Menten kinetics to, gradually feed enough glucose in there so we didn't overwhelm the yeast and all they made was alcohol. They actually put it to good use and made biomass. So it was quite sophisticated. But funnily enough, when I got the interview, I went home and told my wife, said, well, where the hell is Immunex? And I said, well, it's in Seattle, in Washington. And we had no idea where that was. So we had to go next door because there was a schoolgirl and borrow her atlas.
Oh, wow.
To find out where it was. And even though it was that close to Canada, it still didn't put us off.
You had one child at that point in time?
Yes.
The two-year-old didn't get a choice. But I mean, your wife was like, sure, let's change country.
Well, she's a Scot, and I think they historically have shown a great desire to flee their homeland. So, I think she was like, well, if we're going to do something as crazy as this, let's go do it. How bad can it be? We could always come home.
Yeah.
And I guess that was 30 something years ago now.
All right. So you're still at this point in time, you know, animal husbandry expert for yeast. Okay. Yes. You're a little yeast farmer.
Yes.
we haven't got to the epiphany yet.
Well, so I was a yeast farmer, and then I took a job in project management, and that itself had some very interesting stories along with that, including, you know, we launched the first generic paclitaxel in Canada. That came out of, you know, a project that I led. And then from that, I got very interested in this sort of competitive landscape and went to the company and said, we now have this blockbuster in the making drug, Enbrel, and we have no idea what our competitors are doing. Enbrel is for rheumatoid arthritis. So it was a TNF inhibitor. It was the first, you know, subcutaneously administered TNF inhibitor for RA. And the company said, well, you know what? You've kind of been here a few years. You've done the legwork. Yeah, go off and do this. Don't annoy us. Don't do anything too badly. And turned out it was a great success. You know, we had this field force of people who are generally ignored by everyone in head office. So, you know, I had prizes for them. And because they're in with the physicians, like, you know, what do they know about the competitors? What do they think about our drug? And it was really, really successful. And unfortunately, when Immunex got acquired by Amgen, my job got moved to Thousand Oaks. And nothing wrong with Thousand Oaks, but the family voted against not going to Thousand Oaks.
Thousand Oaks being just outside Los Angeles?
Yeah, northwest of Los Angeles. And so part of the acquisition was Immunex had to divest the oncology division of Burlex. And Burlex said, well, okay, we'll set up shop in Seattle. So they did. So they wanted me to go there. But somebody whom I'd worked with or worked for at Immunex had come out of the financial industry. He'd been in both in private equity and public equity. And he'd gone back to private after a brief stint at Immunex. And then he said, you know, I'm taking over the biotech research group, Lehman Brothers. You know, why don't you come join me? You know, you can stay in Seattle. You don't have to move to New York or San Francisco. Basically, you're just going to do what you were doing, which is go to medical meetings, you know, make a nuisance of yourself, you know, try and come up with differentiated ideas about, you know, drugs and products. And, you know, we're going to cover companies and see how it goes.
So that covers a multitude of sins there. But it's funny because all of the companies like Wells Fargo and Lehman Brothers, they've all had scandals associated with them, but I hope they don't track with you. If they do, this isn't the time to announce it publicly, by the way. I think one of the things is I'm still bamboozled. It's kind of like, so Nick, go and find out how our product relates to other products. And now it's like, go and find out how any product relates to other products. And then what do you do with that information?
As an analyst, we cover companies. So, you know, Wells Fargo, I covered about 22 companies, which meant that, you know, I would write an opinion to clients of the firm. And that would be, say, whomever's investing your 401k, for example.
Okay.
You know, they would have some money. They want to invest it in biotech. They may have some investments. They may have to invest 20% of their money in healthcare-related stocks. For example, you know, the more sophisticated organizations, hedge funds, you know, are staffed by MDs, MD PhDs, PhDs, you know, who are doing a lot of their own research. So sort of use us really to help them, like, are we on the right track? Or do we see things the same as the Wells Fargo guys see them? So we have an opinion that we have to write, and it has to tell a client what to do and why. So you buy this stock because, or you sell this stock because, and, you know, because we're optimists most of the time, we're saying buy this stock. We like this product. We think it's going to be a good product. We think you should invest in it. And so really our role is to accelerate the drug development process by attracting investors and investment into companies.
The product is securities in that company.
No, the drug. We're saying, you know, we think Camagkine is going to be, you know,
it's going to be huge.
The best drug in this space. And so, you know, the Camage company is trading at $3 a share. We think, you know, based on our projections and discounting that, the net present value of that is $5. We think the Camage company should be trading at $5. So we think it's a good investment for you. You should buy that. And we think, you know, you should get in before we see the data.
Yeah.
There's a risk here. But, you know, the Camage company trades up to $10. And then, you know, you go, well, it would be nice to have another $250 million in the bank to help us with the phase three. So, you know, we're going to go raise money.
Okay.
And that's always a balance. You know, as an analyst, you hate to get somebody into a stock, they make money, and then much of that gets given back because the company then sells more stock, which dilutes the stock price. You have to take the trading price and dilute it by more shares. But that's the sort of nature of the game here is, picking the good from the bad and really trying to accelerate.
What kind of time scale are you predicting? So is this, having seen the movie, the Big Short or whatever it was called, the idea is like you want something where the stock price is going to go up or down tomorrow and you're going to make money on it, or you're saying this is your 5-year, 10-year investment, whatever.
Yeah. So really our stock price should be what we think the stock can get to in the next 12 to 18 months.
Okay. So an annual report is okay. Cause obviously these things can move very quickly, but you're saying, look, I only need to give you a once a year report because that's the kind of time scale we're talking in years.
Right. And it's rolling. It's rolling. So as we get to ASCO, there's good news and there's bad news. So after ASCO or any major data event, there'll be a revision by the analysts. We either stick with where we are. The data was better than we thought. We think maybe they could get accelerated approval on this. They could get the drug to market faster. Well, this is a big disappointment. They're going to have to go back and they're going to have to, redo this phase 2 trial, different dose, different schedule, different set of patients. That's going to delay everything and therefore we're reducing our price. So it's a moving target. And, you don't want to be doing it every week, but if you're not changing your price target once or twice a year, it's a pretty stale stock. Now the investors, there are investors who are long-term investors. They like the company, they like the management, they like the pipeline. Maybe there's a platform technology that can be used to develop a series of drugs. And so they think, well, we're going to hold this for the long term, We're going to ignore what happens in the next 3 years, 5 years, but we're really looking at a 10-year time frame. And then there's fast money. The hedge funds, they want to know, okay, I don't intend to hold this stock for more than 6 months. I want to turn this stock over.
Yeah.
So I'm investing in something that's volatile and I'm making a guess on if it's going to go up and down. How do banks make money? Well, we sell research. So clients pay us a fee.
Yeah.
Then we also make money trading stocks. So if you like our research, you trade stocks through us. And so hedge funds generate a lot of trading, much more so than long-term clients. The long-term clients are easier to please because they get less disappointed by a short-term, downturn in the stock. But it's a very diverse universe of investors out there. And we're not really talking about individual investors. These are institutional investors for our clients.
On that point, are you as an analyst allowed to own stock yourself? Because when does that become an issue?
So, I have a section here, the wrongs. Over the years, this has got tighter and tighter. I've been doing this 20 years. But right from the very beginning, you could not own a stock in which you had an opinion. So, and that got broadened to any stock covered by the company. And now at Wells, it was any healthcare stock or any derivative. So like an ETF, I couldn't own a healthcare ETF.
What's an ETF?
Like electronically traded fund, where it's a fund of funds. So you might own a fraction of a share of Celgene, a fraction of a share of Bristol.
Okay.
You couldn't influence that by your decision. But, they wanted you to be as far away from any gray area as possible.
Is that frustrating? Because like you're an expert, you're telling people you should invest in this and you're kind of like, well, that's useless because I can't apply it to myself.
Well, it is and it isn't. I think your own personal risk level comes into this. We are looking mainly at high risk, high reward. This is biotech. Often it's a flip of a coin. Often these companies may have one product. So they're either going to, go to the moon or not. As many blow up as are successful.
Do you think it's 50-50 or do you think the proportion's different? My impression is it's 50% are not successful. If you get down to small biotech, it's like most of you guys will be selling the furniture at some point to, keep the lights on.
So I think, you have a basket approach. So, if you look at the companies that we have covered historically, we've covered large biotech stocks as well. So, these have multiple product portfolios. They have a steady income stream, steady cash flow. They're likely to go and acquire companies. Some of them even pay dividends now. So those stocks have less risk.
Yeah. Um,
but less reward. So, you know, you have some of those help protect you from the downside. And then there are the middle players. You have a pretty high conviction this is going to work. This is going to be successful. And it's the small guys really where you get that, you know, the huge potential. You know, we had one, and I'm sure you're going to ask me, you know, how do we do this? But, you know, we had one company several years ago. It was an ophthalmology drug. And the first guy that ever injected Avastin into somebody's eye has his own little meeting he runs in Florida. So, okay. You know, we go along to this, and there's probably me and maybe one other analyst in the audience. And he's very excited because his postdoctoral student has done pharmacokinetic study of this drug in the eye. Yeah. Like, well, you can't do that in humans. The leading drug was an antibody fragment. And so he puts this curve up, and it's the PK in the eye. And I look at this and I go, that's a massive difference. So I called my boss and he said, wow, that's fantastic. Okay. So the next morning, you know, he's out like, okay, we've got this data point. Nobody else has got it. And we think this is going to be massive. The current drug sells, you know, X hundred million dollars a year. We think this is going to be a multi-billion dollar a year drug where I can't remember what he increased the price to, but we're doubling our target.
Yeah.
And that's now the fifth best-selling drug of last year.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Is that true? You know, we've had some abject failures as well.
You started this with the intro was like, I'm now going to talk about the wrongs. And I'm not sure we got to any wrongs other than the fact you said you weren't allowed to buy shares.
Ah, yes.
So I didn't get your confession here. Yes.
The investment bank is really two big divisions. There's the research division, which is what I do, write research. And then there's the finance division. That is taking companies public. You know, they're doing corporate development, acquisitions, mergers. And so, you know, in order for the bank to get, you know, a secondary financing, it would be nice if there's positive research. So the bankers would call up the research analysts and say, you know, can you write something nice about Amage? Yeah. You know, his company, you know, wants to raise $100 million and we want to get a nice fat fee. So the analyst would write, Camage Kine, we think is brilliant, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And then it would send an email to the bank saying, this is the biggest piece of crap I've ever seen. You know.
Yeah.
So there was this complete dichotomy.
That sounds very dodgy.
This,
yeah.
Exactly. Very dodgy. So of course this, everyone got in trouble. And so then they came in and said, okay, research is over here. Banking's over here. Compliance is in the middle. You know, the two groups can never talk unless it's moderated by compliance.
Wow.
And compliance is staffed with a bunch of lawyers and it's very, very strict. So that was kind of, you know, in either personal investing or this saying one thing to your clients and saying a different thing internally.
Yeah.
Kind of one of the big no's. Another one of the no's, and it's happened as well, and I'd be interested, you know, what the University of Colorado has to say about this, is there have been physicians who are working on a drug and they hear about some good data. And so then they go buy the stock before it's publicly announced. So this is material non-public information. So that's the biggest thing we have to deal with, is if you hear material non-public information, good or bad, you know, what do you do with that?
So, I mean, I guess there are different viewpoints. I'm kind of a bit more of a purist. And so if you think my investment in myself is the long term, not the short term. And so I figure you only have a reputation once. I don't own, to my knowledge, any biotech stock, any pharmaceutical stock. And I'm okay with that. I get rewarded in a different way. But you're right, I do know of colleagues who have sort of skirted that. And I think that's inappropriate and very dangerous.
Now, some institutions, I think, have, you know, very strict guidelines. What about the university?
I've never actually looked at the guidelines in that, so I apologize to all those compliance people from the university who are listening to this. They'll double our listeners. I mean, I just think I have a kind of moral compass that's telling me that that's not something I should be doing.
Yeah. Those can be a bit...
The moral compass.
Few and far between, but sometimes...
You know, the other way. So very early in my career, somebody said to me, they said, look, you might sit there and debate whether it's right or wrong, but how would you feel if it appeared in the paper the next day? And if you just go, that's going to come over wrong, you just shouldn't be doing it. That's the yardstick for me.
That was kind of one of my comments is, you know, think about what you're doing as a headline that your mum reads in a local paper.
I don't know, like she'd still be proud either way. Look at my son, he's gone to jail. Look, I'm so proud of him.
Made a load of money. You know, what was kind of interesting to me and slightly scary, I mean, you know, very Orwellian, is Wells Fargo at the system that screened every email that was sent.
That sounds, I don't know if I'd want to work there. What if I want to send a little funny joke with a smiley emoji on it?
They're really looking for, you know, this malfeasance and malpractice. And the funny thing was, you know, because you would send me an email sometimes and, you know, you'd have a little witticism in there and I'd cringe like, oh my God, I hope this doesn't get picked up by the filters. But, you know, that they take it very, very, very seriously. I mean, you know, Wells Fargo dinged their reputation big time. Now, that was the High Street Bank.
Yeah.
They'll get tarred with the same brush and they feel like they have to monitor and text messages, emails, all get screened to make sure that, you know, our moral compass points in the right direction.
Yeah, the other thing I do, and we'll get to how you interact with, you know, physicians and academics in a second, but I always try and think, okay, is this scuttlebutt that somebody's heard or I've been in some kind of confidential meeting? And that kind of somehow gets walled off in my brain. I have quite a visual memory. So if I've seen it presented publicly, I know, and I'm okay to talk about that. But anything else that, you know, I can't imagine an audience sitting there that is, you know, not somehow privileged, then that doesn't get talked about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you know, one of the things that I'm going to segue a little bit here is, I can't remember if I told you this, but I spent 18 months of my training in AstraZeneca. And one of the things that really blew my mind, even for big pharma, is how much a share price can depend only on like a single product. Mm-hmm. And you imagine that, you know, these things, like you said, have, you know, multiple things in their portfolio. I get it when it's a small company with one product, but even a company with a big portfolio, they can still be such a dominant blockbuster that, you know, the patent life of that really determines the finances of the company.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think, you know, Tagrisso is what, like the fifth or sixth best-selling drug in oncology now.
Yes.
Last year, it's moving up there, But I think, you know, over the 10 best-selling drugs last year, I looked this up, the 10 best-selling drugs, 8 were developed by biotech. Now, you know, I may be taking a little bit of a liberty there. You know, okay, Humira, the biggest selling drug, was developed by BASF, but they had to go to Cambridge Antibody Technology to develop it. You know, they said, we want an antibody against this. And I think even Keytruda started life at Organon, whether that's a biotech or not is debatable. But, you know, 8 were developed at biotech. Interestingly, 6 of those are monoclonal antibodies. And, you know, of those drugs, you know, 5 are in oncology. Wow. Now, the teams that I've worked for over the years have covered 3 companies developing 4 of those top 10 drugs.
Wow. Now, that's so a good record.
It's sort of part of the ecosystem. If you just focus on oncology, you know, 7 were developed by biotechs. Interestingly, there, 4 are liquid tumors, 3 are for myeloma. So 3 of the best-selling oncology drugs are for myeloma.
Wow.
Which is quite surprising. As an analyst, if somebody's coming to me saying, hey, I got this really good idea for myeloma.
And Nick, when you're saying best-selling, you're talking number of units or dollar value? So a small number of units, but high dollar value could be best-selling. Exactly. Okay.
Because I think Keytruda in 2021 was like the 200th most prescribed drug in the US.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, so broad indications, but yeah, even a narrow indication, but with a super expensive drug could still get you up there.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, some of the things that, you know, I think what part of the role we play is when we're looking at this, like really myeloma, you know, is there room in myeloma for, you know, another blockbuster?
Yeah.
And interestingly, you know, monoclonal antibodies, I think, you know, when you look at this, there are a lot of monoclonal antibodies in this top 10. And I often think of monoclonal antibodies as targeting, you know, sort of the low-hanging fruit. Yeah, there are some monoclonals that are now looking at isoforms, you know, of proteins or glycosylated isoforms of proteins. But even so, you know, are we going to see another rash of new monoclonal antibodies that are really going to, you know, drive valuation in these companies now? Should we be looking at new modalities? What is the future? And that, you know, part of the role as an analyst is not only looking at publicly traded companies, but via compliance is looking at what's emerging in private sector. And, you know, compared to what I did in industry where I was focused on one or two projects, you know, I say to people, the great thing about an analyst is like a butterfly, you know, you're a neurology meeting one week. This is
perfect for ADHD.
Yeah. Right, exactly. You know, a rheumatology meeting, a gastro meeting, an infectious diseases meeting, an oncology meeting. You know, you get to flutter from flower to flower. And, in that now, you know, via the vetting process, you get to look at the juiciest buds as well. So
let me ask a little bit where, you know, we on this side of the fence would be interacting you on the other side of the fence is, when is there value, or how do you use, you know, speaking to physicians, other researchers? So not necessarily the pharma people who, you know, have a product that you may or may not buy, but, you know, the loosely called key opinion leaders, which I always think is a slightly weird term.
The KOLs, yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of what we're trying to do, I mean, the whole point, there, if there are 40 biotech analysts, you know, and a press release comes out tomorrow from the Camage company and we all write on it. I mean, what can we say?
Yeah.
Sort of reiterating in the press release. So we have to have a differentiated opinion. And to me, that's like putting a bit of a jigsaw puzzle together because, you know, okay, you have the data for CamageKine. Well, are there competitors? What's the competitor data saying? Have there been any disappointments? I'm a great one for looking in the literature. So I would screen PubMed and try and find maybe somebody who's got an opinion about this class of drug or, you know, has written an op-ed in the JCO on approval of this drug and what it means. And so, you know, what I'm looking for is, I mean, I have my opinion, but as I said, you know, we're not experts. So we go to an expert and we want to get their opinion. I mean, if this drug were to be approved, how would you use it? You know, what are the downsides? What are the upsides? Is there anything in the competitive landscape that we don't know about we should be paying attention to? Even things like, you know, are there any reimbursement changes on the horizon that, you know, you feel like, oh, you know, nobody's going to be using oral drugs because we're going to get paid so much money for infusing drugs. So
yeah,
we're all going to be infusing drugs. Like, you know, we know the data, but now how do we round out our knowledge base?
I mean, everyone has an opinion, right? They're like other parts of our anatomy. Everyone has one. My experience of seeing people with opinions is, like you say, you know, an editorial or the discussion of a publication. But I see huge variation in terms of the insights that people get, ranging from essentially like the worst movie review that just tells you the plot of the movie you've just seen to, yeah, you know, tremendous insight in terms of putting it into some kind of context. So how does that play out in terms of your interactions with us on this side of the fence?
Well, I think the one thing I can say is if you get a call back from me, I found it useful. You know, everybody has an opinion, but sometimes, you know, especially I think, you know, some physicians I've spoken with are, I won't say too close to the company, but they really don't want to give you an opinion. They kind of skirt around the issue. They can always find, you know, something good to say about anything. I just feel like they're not willing to give me an opinion I think has any value. Now, it's true to say, you know, I mean, there are companies that have arrangements with panels of physicians. And so, you know, you can go to these companies and say, I want to speak to five, you know, hematologists next week who have prescribed this drug.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll get back 10 responses and, you know, you pick five people. And so it can become a bit of a commodity. You know, some of those companies, you could have those physicians go on a call with you to clients. That's the other part of this as well is, do you think that this physician has enough to say that's interesting and value add that you want to either host a call with them where you invite clients or on a more intimate level, you know, go to a dinner. Some clients then get some one-on-one time with the physician. And so I think when you have the most valuable insights, you know, you feel like this is a good investment. You know, we really, research is a cost center for the bank. If I'm going to spend some money on this video cast or taking physicians to dinner, then I want to make sure I get some value out of that. And so, you know, again, it all comes down to, well, we got a relationship with this physician via this analyst. So we look favorably on that analyst. And, you know, they have a beauty contest every year for the analysts. So they'll vote for who their best analyst is. And institutional really? Best is very nice. Important.
Yeah.
You know, companies will, you know, pay more or less for your research based on the, you know, their interaction with all the analysts. So,
I mean, I don't remember when you and I first interacted, but I do recall, I mentioned this to you the other day, that it was at a point in my career where just the fact that anyone cared what I was saying, I actually found tremendously empowering. And so, mm-hmm. and you're very easy to speak to. And so there was an element of, well, you know, I actually would learn things from you that I hadn't thought about, because you would look at things in a different way. And the same is true with many of the analysts that I've spoken to. But I think you really, in a sense, really helped my confidence. And I think you helped change my thinking about what analysts were looking for, you know, when we're talking about companies. And so I always draw analogies with something like X Factor. And, you know, I always try not to be Paula Abdul and try and be more sort of, you know, Simon Cowell, because it may not be what you want to hear, but it's the truth as I perceive it.
Exactly. And I think that's critical. And I can't remember when we first interacted, but you definitely had black hair then. So
no, thanks very much.
I know this is audio only.
Yeah. So for those listening, I have glossy blonde hair, which looks a lot like gray hair. But
you know, one thing I always tried to do was to make it more of a two-way street. Obviously, you know, the physicians get paid for their time, and so that obviously is very attractive for them. But to be able to provide some additional information to them, additional resources, or, you know, as you say, different points of view, I think, was something I always strive to do. You know, it really annoyed me. I'd be standing by a poster at ASCO or ASH, and, you know, two young analysts would roll up, and the first thing they do is they don't ask a single question about the poster. They just ask the physician, is this drug good or bad?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that, having stood at the poster, you can always tell the analysts, because they don't ask you about your poster. What they ask you is, how does your drug compare to other drugs out there?
Right.
That's, an academic never asks that. You know, that's only an analyst asks that.
So, you know, I always take a different approach. You know, I always want to engage with the presenter, talk about the poster.
And then, you know, the soft sell, very clever.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, when you asked me at the beginning, how did I get into this? I mean, for me, it was serendipity. But obviously, as you've seen, there are a lot of young people are analysts, and it's a hard job. You know, particularly on the biotech side, a lot of MDs, PhDs, with or without an MBA. I mean, there are people whose career is to become an analyst. You know, they finish medical school, never treat a patient, and just go work on Wall Street.
We have, you know, in terms of your list of wrongs, occasionally we've had sort of complete charlatans who are clearly analysts phoning up. So I remember some guy phoning up saying, I'm a pharmacist and I want to prescribe this drug for my patient, and I just need to know how the first 20 patients have done and their, you know, efficacy results. And it's like, that doesn't sound right. And then you kind of get them on the phone and you go, really, what's this going to go? Well, I have a sideline as an analyst. And you just go, okay, thanks. But no, thanks.
That's something that, you know, really, you know, should not be allowed. I mean, in every profession, there's a gray area.
Yeah.
You know, you say your moral compass, you know, how close you get to that gray area, whether you step in it, you know, is how well you sleep at night. And as you said, you know, if your mum reads about it in the paper, you know, it's going to be a little embarrassing. And it's not just embarrassing to you, it's embarrassing to the firm.
Yeah.
And, you know, working for somewhere like Wells Fargo, you know, they've stubbed their toe badly enough. The last thing they need is me to pile on the agony. So, you know, it goes beyond you. It's the, you know, credibility of your organization as well.
One question I've always wondered is, what makes a good investment?
You know, if I knew the answer to that, Ross.
You'd retired years beforehand, right?
I mean, it is really interesting from when I first started as an analyst, you know, where particularly in oncology, you know, you used to have to get the magnifying glass out to try and spot the gap between the survival lines.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we've had this obviously massive increase in our understanding of the biology of cancer. And even with that, you know, we still go off on these little detours into areas that have some biologic relevance to cancer, but, you know, don't hit it hard in the solar plexus so it doesn't get up.
Yeah.
So for me, it has to be a biologically driven rationale. And I really want to see single agent targeting of the cancer. I don't think we're sophisticated enough yet to be layering in metabolic plays. It's helpful if there's a validated regulatory strategy, but that doesn't mean that FDA can't shift the goalpost. Last year, you know, one of the drugs I was really excited about, FDA suddenly said to the company, well, you know, we hear everything you're saying and it all sounds very good, but we want overall survival. Well, this is in follicular lymphoma.
Wow.
So you might as well hibernate for the next 10 years. So if there's a validated regulatory strategy, I think you do want an experienced management team. You know, everyone has to have their first rodeo, but, you know, it's good to have some experienced people there. And then obviously, you know, everything is based on a model. You know, know, what do we think this thing is going to sell?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we discount that back. It would be nice to have a validated market opportunity, but even if it's not, you know, we need to understand the market opportunity. And then, and what's really important with high interest rates is money to develop the drug. Sadly, there are several biotechs that have, you know, 3 months, 6 months of cash. And that's really, really challenging. You know, a stock price generally reflects 6 months ahead of where the market is. So, you know, if you've got less than 12 months of cash, it's a significant challenge. So those are the things that I like to have.
You know, it's funny you touch on that, because when I speak to analysts, the most common one is like, this is a company and they've got this new drug, which is in the same class as the other ones. You know, is it going to be better or worse?
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to have an argument that your efficacy is going to be better based on something other than it's our drug.
Yeah, you
know,
right.
You know, if you're a fifth in line with a PD-1 inhibitor, if your small study looks a little bit better, that's just the tyranny of small numbers. You know, unless you really know why, as opposed to, hey, look, our results are better. We're amazing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's an important point is, you know, the analyst community is very, very close to the company management, but they're a filter for the Kool-Aid to the client. You know, this is what the company's saying, but this is not what they're telling you.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the set of data, but they didn't give you detail about, you know, this death that's kind of buried
Well, that's the other thing I look for is not all presentations are cookie cutter. And so right. To some extent they are, but when they deviate from that, you know, why are you presenting the data like this? Why are you not showing this piece of data?
Yes.
None of this happens by chance. There's a strategy somewhere. And the key thing, or the fun bit, is to suddenly develop insights into that. And you can go, they didn't show that. Maybe because X, Y, and Z.
Right. Exactly. Analysts have long memories. So if you tell me, you know, 18 months ago that you're going to have biologic correlate data with your phase one presented with the phase one data, and you don't present that.
That's telling you something. Yeah. That was the thing I learned from analysts, is that you can go on clinicaltrials.gov and you can click on this button that I've never had to click on before. And it tells you the amendments to the protocol. Yeah. And you sort of go, they can deduce things like what's going wrong and why do they have to amend it? And when was the last patient in and why haven't we seen the results?
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of metadata there. Yeah.
Metadata being sort of tea leaf reading, but yes.
No, it's kind of behind, a little behind the scenes. And exactly. That's really the fun of the job, is trying to put that jigsaw together of, okay, here's the public piece. Everyone's got this.
Yeah.
What can you put together that, you know, takes a little bit of insight, experience?
Yeah. Nick, this has been fascinating. Normally, I have people sort of earlier in their careers, hence you had your crack about the color of my hair. But you are also entering a new and exciting phase of your life with retirement. When did you actually retire?
End of September last year.
Oh, yeah. So not even a year. So I'm going to ask you the same thing. So going forward in the next few years, you know, what are you excited about in Nick Abbott's life, family, maybe even continuing to work? But, you know, what's the future hold for you?
Well, I think investing in myself, I want to live to like 90 plus.
I don't know many happy 90-year-olds, but you could be the first. You're very fit.
I tend to be. You know, I bought myself an electric bike. I cycle to the gym. I work out strenuously. I told you when we were recording this, I need at least an hour to recover after work.
Maybe as you get fitter, it'll take you less time to recover. Yeah.
And travel, you know, travel. My wife and I love to travel. Both our kids are grown up. We have a couple of grandchildren, so we spend much more time with the grandchildren. It's fun watching them grow up. Never cleaned so many windows in my life. You know, they have bloody handprints everywhere, all over the windows.
Wow, yeah.
There have been a couple of people that have reached out to me and said, hey, would you like to do a little bit of consulting for us? And I'm happy to do that. I used to tell people, you know, being an analyst, you work 13 months a year because you spend so many weekends at medical meetings, you know.
Wow.
It's a hard life. It's tough. And it was funny. I was at the airport the other week with my wife. We were at the Alaska Airlines terminal. I said, I have PTSD because, you know, historically I would rush in there, get my laptop out, plug it in, bang away on the keyboard until I said, Dr. Abbott, please get on the plane. And then, you know, close it down. Dash
that was you. Plane. You're the guy delaying the flight. Now I know.
Yeah, I have PTSD about that. But and I'm not sure I can ever go to Chicago again.
You know, it would feel weird. Not in the first week of June. Yeah.
Not in the first week of June. Yeah. But even so, you know, I mean, because it wasn't just ASCO in Chicago. Major meetings all over the place. So the one thing I would like to say, Ross, that being an analyst has helped me is, sadly, over the years, we've had many friends and acquaintances diagnosed with cancer. And as you know, this is a frightening and perilous journey. And I've offered to go along to the oncologist with them. Say, look, I'm going to take notes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're shell-shocked. And so I've sort of become an advocate. I don't know how really to expand that, but it's been really useful. Well, you know, one fellow, I got him in at Fred Hutch, and we went to Fred Hutch, and I'm like, look, can we do a sequencing to find out what the driver mutation is? And you know, after a bit of back and forth, says, well, I think I can get him on a research protocol, because of course, you know, his insurance wasn't going to pay for that. So we found out what his driver was. Like, okay, well, let's stay in touch. You know, thankfully he's in remission at the moment, but if it comes back, where's there a clinical protocol we can get him on? So, you know, I'm sort of leveraging I know enough to be dangerous knowledge, but also having worked with physicians and seen clinical trials and how drugs get developed, is to try and how can I leverage this to benefit somebody who otherwise, you know, would just be a deer in the headlights.
That's fantastic. I'd never thought about that, but you're right. Kind of ex-analysts are probably the perfect advocates because they can be objective. They can, you know, look at the data and they know how the system works.
Yeah.
So, right. Well, I look forward to that being a very successful part of your new life.
I hope so.
Thanks so much for talking to us.
Great. Thanks, Ross. Enjoyed it.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.